Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that might just be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Stephen, how
are you? Hey, Phil. I'm doing great, man.
Man, I made you a host before a futurist, and
that's the first time I think you've ever done that. Oh well,
I can mix it up, but I shouldn't mix myself up in the process. I think that's,
that's right.
A real issue there. So we've got the for those listening in, I won't say North America because this is specific to the United States. This is Thanksgiving week, and I have completed my work week except for a few things I have to finish up after the podcast tonight. How about you, Stephen? You one of these guys who still pushes on through Wednesday, or
absolutely?
Have you adopted the 5-day weekend?
I would like to have taken off today, but I'll be with it all day tomorrow, and then I'll have Thursday and Friday off.
Oh, okay, all right. So you're still doing the traditional 4-day weekend.
That's it.
Rocking it old school. Okay.
Exactly. If I get a 5-day weekend, it'll be because I take Monday off.
Now that would be the other way to do it, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And the other partner is out this week, and he's taking that would be like a 9-day weekend because he's taking the entire week off, and so I need to be around. And so that's why I'm old school this week. So
I see. Well, I think working is a good thing. I wouldn't discourage it. Although in the future, you might think about this. I'm just throwing this out there, not for this week, but future Thanksgiving weeks. If you took the Tuesday off and then the following Monday, 6-day weekend.
Okay. All right. Yeah, there you go.
I'm just throwing it out there.
There you go. So they maximize the number of straight days in a row that you're off. Yeah.
You know, it's a future that's hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Make sure people know.
Maximum time off.
I'm not just kidding, okay? We get into this stuff on this show. It's all happening here. So anyway, Thanksgiving week coming up. We stand back for a moment, have an attitude of gratitude. So what are you thankful for, Stephen, going into Thanksgiving week?
Well, my son was injured this weekend. He hurt his foot, several broken bones in his foot. I'm thankful, I guess, first and foremost, that clean break. Got him in a cast. He's going to heal up in a few weeks and not have any further problems with it. So I guess just in a larger sense, the health of my family. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, I will
something
you
don't tend
that.
To appreciate until, you know, something like, you know, I mean, really, we're going along, we just living life, and you don't really think about, you know, being sick or being injured until you are. So
yeah, you don't really appreciate it until it's being messed with, something.
Yeah.
Your health. That's so true for yourself or for members of your family. Yeah, I'm also very much thankful for my beautiful, beautiful family, my beautiful baby girl, my older baby girl, and my darling wife. Very thankful to have all of them in my life. And I've got another interesting Thanksgiving story. The one of my colleagues put a notice up on the bulletin board at work. He had Broncos tickets. He had two sets of Broncos tickets for Sunday and for Thursday. So we're playing the Thanksgiving night game, and we also had a game on Sunday. Both of them are home games. And great seats he had, and he was selling them for $190 for the pair. And it was Friday afternoon. I'm going, hey, you know what? This is this would be pretty cool. So I'm trying to work angles. I'm like, call my wife, hey, what do you think? No. You know, I'm trying to line my brother up. No, he can't do it. Thinking, oh, my daughter, no, that's not going to work. And by the end of the day, the guy was so desperate, he had dropped from 190 to 150. And I'm like, oh, man, I got to go to this game. And just I couldn't make the connection. I could not close the deal. I would have ended up buying one ticket and going by myself, and that didn't sound like fun. So I ended up not getting to go to the game. Ended up watching the game at home on my couch. And I'll tell you, by about the third quarter, I was so thankful that I didn't pay $150 to go to that football game.
Yeah, you sat there just kicking yourself for having gone.
I couldn't believe how grateful I was that didn't
this,
work out.
Right here, I think we've demonstrated the difference between a casual fan and, like, one of the solid rock hard fans that are at every single game. You know, they got the season tickets and things like that. That's not Phil.
Right. Well, let me tell you, I don't know if they've all become casual fans or what, but I happened to turn the game on at about the 2-minute warning mark, and the stadium had basically emptied. Okay, they were down to about 20% of the original crowd. Okay, so I think there's a lot more fans like me these days than the other. You want some hope, I guess that's the thing. You want there to be some small chance that your team's going to pull it out, and it didn't look like that was the case at all. So that's my Thanksgiving story. Well, we got some interesting stuff to talk about. Why don't we jump into it? I see that DC has joined us in the chat room. We're going to be getting to your question in just a little bit, DC. So thanks for joining us this evening.
Yeah, he asked a brilliant question in the comments back at the Speculist, and so we're going to spend a good bit of the show, I think, getting into that. But we're going to kind of set that up by really answering the three questions we asked last week.
Right. The three questions we posed in the announcement for the program that we never actually talked about. We kind of talked around these issues, so they're not going to be completely new. But let's just look at these. We're addressing the subject of the process from pre-human to post-human. And as I described it last week, that occurs in three easy steps, and we talked about a model that Josh Hall provided over on the Foresight blog, where he described artificial intelligence evolving from this current kind of insect stage to a sort of a pre-human, highly intelligent stage, to a human-level stage, to something beyond that, and then even to a stage beyond that. But the from pre-human to post-human was encapsulated in three steps, and then I guess you get to post-human. I'm not sure how you describe that, but in the process of talking about that, we had raised these questions, and the first one is, what are the challenges faced in trying to develop a human-level artificial intelligence? I think we talked about a few of those last week. The big one that came up was the ethical dimension.
Yeah. Well, we spent a lot of time on that, but, I mean, if we take the question at its most literal, and just that, how tough is it going to be to make human-level artificial intelligence? I think that, think of it this way. Is there anything that we know of in this universe, that we have had, actual physical contact with, anything more complex in the physical universe than the human mind, the human brain? Any structure that you can think of? I can't think of anything.
I don't think there is. I think even the phone system or the internet or one of these large collective man-made systems actually pales in comparison to a single human brain currently. Anyway,
currently, and so if it's the most complex thing we've ever run across, it's going to be difficult to engineer something of similar complexity. Think about it this way: if you're Marco Polo and you go to an entirely new civilization, and you see all these wonderful, weird things that you had not seen before, and you go back home and you describe them, and he might have even been able to describe some things in such a way that they could actually have been rebuilt right there in Europe, when he went home.
Right.
Because the level of complexity, even of something, really nifty like Chinese architecture. If he's a good sketcher and he could sketch it out and everything like that, it probably could have been built right back there in Europe. But, you can't send a Marco Polo into the mine yet. And so that's, and then come back. And even if you could, I mean, what's he going to sketch and what's he going to describe? I mean, it's just too complex.
Well, it goes back to I had talked about the talk that Jaime Casquio gave a few weeks ago, and one of the things he said in that was that intelligence might just end up being a much, much, much harder nut to crack than we imagine that it is. And we imagine it's pretty tough. We imagine it to be a significant challenge that we're taking on, but it could very well be more elusive than we even realize, or than we're even capable of realizing at our current level of understanding. So just the technical challenge of getting intelligence to happen could hold us back for a long time. And then he had talked about some other things, dead-end technology paths and possible regulations, also backlash potentially against AI and related technologies. And that's an interesting one because we have not seen too much of that to date when artificial intelligence technology takes over human jobs. But, you know, as they start working their way up the value chain, we were talking last week about robots that take over your job or my job, say 60% of the knowledge worker jobs that are out there. When that is threatening, you know, do we start to see a backlash? Well, we might if that actually creates a vacuum and then there aren't jobs for those other people. The other possibility is that creates different jobs for that existing 60%.
That's right.
And I think Robin Hanson has written about that, how to date automating jobs has not reduced the number of jobs. It has actually net increased the number. We don't know if over a very brief period of time, say 18 months, 2-3 years, virtually all knowledge worker jobs can be automated, what consequences that has politically, economically. It's really hard to say, but a potential backlash against that sort of thing is possible. And I think the last thing that Jaime listed there factors very heavily into it, which is just plain fear. Once people see intelligence achieving that level, right? When they see intelligence that can threaten them from a livelihood standpoint, then they might start to think, well, maybe this can threaten me in other ways too. It becomes an other, and it becomes a threat, and people become fearful of it. I think all those kind of sociological forces could come into play and could definitely slow things down. So being mindful of those possible outcomes, being mindful of where a particular breakthrough in artificial intelligence is taking us, and being mindful of how it's being implemented and what the impact is and how that impact is being perceived, that's all going to play huge into whether we advance in a fairly smooth and straightforward way, or whether we do it really in, you know, major fits and starts with a lot of backtracking and confusion along the way.
I think some of it may, social unrest. It might be a function of how well the wealth that's created by these new AIs is distributed. You know, if AIs are expensive and they and it takes a major corporation to do it, and it ends up concentrating wealth more among a certain elite, and those who are have-nots or can't tap into that wealth. I think that would be a would be a problem. But if everybody's getting rich, even though they're not having to work as hard, I think that. There might be different social problems with that, but it's hard to imagine them being too upset by it. People being upset by that, so it could be problems associated with just being idle all the time. But I can't imagine people that are getting wealthy with working very little being too upset with that problem.
Well, absolutely. That is, I guess. Got to be the optimum scenario, right?
Yeah.
That's the one we really want to work for. And that applies to artificial intelligence, and it applies to nanotechnology, which we'll also be talking about over the next 2 weeks, and ultimately we'll end up with a program about just all the issues surrounding this free economy. But one of the things I think that it's important for us to do as we look at this problem is to kind of plot out what the likely major ways forward would be. And there's this optimum one that you just described, wherein actually people's attitudes would likely be very positive towards AIs taking on the work, because they'd have less work to do, as you said, and they'd get the money. And that seems like a pretty good deal, right? I mean, it's the you start realizing the four-hour work week, right, at that point, or something even less. People are positively motivated to move ahead with this kind of artificial intelligence revolution. You know, what are the other scenarios? I think that we mentioned one, which is where everyone loses their job, and you know, there's like rampant poverty. It's like a Great Depression for one sector of the economy, and then whoever it is who owns all the AIs, well, they cash in. But you know what I think, Stephen? I think there are probably three or four other variations that go off in different directions that probably need to be looked at. And off the top of my head, I don't know what those are, but somehow we need to plot those out and say, actually, get it down to about four, right? That's what I like.
Worst possible future would be Terminator, right? I mean,
well,
where the AIs just decide that all humans need to die, and then boom, okay, that's the worst possible future with an AI, okay?
Right.
I would guess that what we described with the elites getting all the value out of it, and the vast majority of people sitting there, you know, unemployed and not being able to contribute or receive anything from the economy, would be the second worst. And then you'd have different levels of that, all the way down to where pretty much everybody has a desktop computer that's, you know, brilliant and extremely, extremely smart and does work, and everybody gets the value of that, and they go off and be craftsmen or whatever, you know, artists or whatever it is that people want to do with their time at that point. So I guess maybe that's the best scenario.
No, that's third. The best one, I guess, is where we go straight into sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers, right?
There you go. We're actually changing our, we're not just staying unaltered humans. We actually can change as well. Yeah,
we take that next step up. And you know what? Those could be alternatives, or they could all be phases. It's possible that we move through all of those.
Except for Terminator.
Well, actually, there's no way to move through that Terminator one. We move through the other three. Although, if we can skip that second one, I think we're a lot better off. And as Ken points out, rampant poverty would create a political backlash. No question about it. There would be huge repercussions to any technology that comes along and deprives people of their livelihood. Or even that is perceived as threatening to do that. But if it's perceived as offering something tangible, offering something really outside of what people were expecting the economy to be able to offer them, then I think, you know, they're going to be positively disposed, as long as some of those benefits eventually start to show up. I guess that's kind of the
kicker. Well, you know, in his new book, Cory Doctorow, his new book, Makers, you pointed me to this book, by the way, Phil. He imagines a future where...
Now, do you have it on the Kindle yet, is my question for you.
Not yet.
Oh, okay.
I need to get that on the Kindle, though. In fact, I think one of his books I can get on the Kindle absolutely free, because he's kind of that way. He's into the free economy in a big way. He's put his book where his mouth is on that issue. But anyway, Doctorow's book, Makers, is not about AI so much as it is about nanofactories. But the point is, all these people end up unemployed in shantytowns. And I question that future a little bit. Maybe there might be a like you say, a phase where there's lots of unemployed people and they're temporarily out of work and have no money and that kind of thing. But how could it be that people end up in shantytowns when there are machines that can fit in your garage that crank out anything you need? I can't imagine being there being, you know, 1930s style Hoovervilles in a world that, and you know, where those kind of machines are readily available.
Well, I can't imagine that either, except for the possibility that access to those machines is very tightly controlled.
And, there you go.
You know, the main run of people just don't have access to that technology, that it's owned by big corporations and they're keeping it for their own profit making purposes, and regular folks don't have access. Although I would think that there'd be like limited edition versions of those machines that would be widely distributed that would at least print out nice houses, right, so that people wouldn't have to live in shanty. You know,
well, I just don't see how a corporation could make a profit if their potential customers are living in Hoovervilles. You know that people have to have money to participate, and so I don't see that as a particularly attractive end game for corporations.
Right, but I think you have to read the book before you evaluate the scenario completely.
And I have not, and that's fair. I need to read the book before I make any.
He might make it make sense.
Exactly. I'm sure that Dr. Ray has made it make sense. So I'll get into it, and we'll report back in a couple of weeks when we get
to the free economy. Let's talk about that book. I will download it to my iPhone and read it there, and you can read it on your Kindle or your iPhone, Mr. Gadget. And we'll make that part of our discussion on one of the upcoming shows. So let's move on to the next question, which was,
when do humans stop being human?
Stop being human. Now, this is interesting because drawing this line between human and post-human has ramifications if you get to post-human by way of machine, but it has different ramifications if you get to post-human by way of starting with a human, or as we like to call them, a mosh from the Kurzweil books, a mostly original substrate human.
Well, as I said last week, as am I, but there are a few of us that already have some artificial parts, I wear eyeglasses, so I guess that counts as some sort of augmentation, right? But it's I imagine a future where much more integrated technology is in the average person walking down the street. In answering the question, when do humans stop being human, maybe we should just real quickly answer the question, when did humans start being human? Do you consider a Neanderthal a human? Are other cousins, Erectus, what are the others?
Homo Erectus, and before
the new
Homo
little hobbit guy, Florentine,
Homo Florensis. Yeah. How about back to... what is it? Australopithecus, right? That's the original model, right? Nothing before that, I think, is called human, even in the very broadest sense. Well, let me speak as a product marketing person just for a moment, because I represent in my day job a software product that is it's a database. It's called Sybase IQ, and there is a core product, which has a lot of features and is a big enterprise-level product, but it's actually part of this entire family of related technologies that we then refer to as the Sybase IQ whole product. Okay, so I think when we look at humanity, I think there might be a distinction between core humanity and kind of the whole product humanity, all right, sort of the greater humanity, right?
Right.
And certainly greater humanity would extend all the way back to Lucy, and would extend all the way to whatever, I think. It would extend to, who was it, James Hughes and Elias Yudkowsky, watching the proton decay of the universe, right, to however many trillion years from now when the universe comes to an end. So that's greater humanity. But let's rope it in tighter than that, okay? Humanity, let's say, started with Homo sapiens sapiens, okay? So we're not even going to count Neanderthal. All right?
Well, here's what I would say. Humanity, for the point, you know, there's humanity biologically, okay? And there's also the idea that, what makes a person a person? And I think that what we think about when we think about a person is someone who is self-aware, who looks out on the world and you know, some things you know, make him go whoa, and you know what I'm saying. He communicates. He's able to speak. You know, the complex thoughts are able to be communicated one with another, and knowledge is passed from generation to generation.
Right.
Animals don't have those same abilities, and
right.
And don't reflect on the world the same way. And so, I think that, and the reason I would classify, you know when people started like burying their dead and like putting, you know, the tools of that they used in their lifetime and buried them with their dead, you know, for the thought of, maybe he'll have an afterlife and he'll need his bow and he'll need his flint and he'll need, in the afterlife or whatever. When people started thinking along those lines and thinking big questions, I think that's an important part of what being human is. And I say all that to answer the question, when do we stop being human? I don't see us stopping being human, because we will take all these things with us going forward. Now,
right.
You know, biologically we may be quite a bit different. Mentally we might be a lot more advanced, but I think a lot of the, we will be building on this. We will not lose anything. Necessarily, we'll build on it. That's the hope, anyway.
Okay. Well,
does that make sense?
It makes good sense. So actually, just to round out the when did we start? So with your definition, humanity would have started back with Neanderthals, and I think maybe it gets mushy and fuzzy, but to a certain extent, even with Homo erectus, I think they did some of those behaviors.
Yeah, they made tools and they buried their dead and they did. And there's evidence that Homo erectus made musical instruments, things like that. So it wasn't just tooth and claw survival for some of our cousins. So yeah, and so going forward, even if we're augmenting ourselves, there are certain things about us as humans that we're going to want to keep as we go forward, and that's. And the basic things about us as humans that we're not going to throw out are things like music and things like beauty and art and things like that. So, I mean, you know, I don't see us turning ourselves into Borg, at least not voluntarily.
Well, Borg in the cultural sense, not necessarily in the technological sense, because I do see us turning ourselves into Borg in terms of having implants and.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. I think we'll do implants and things. We'll probably do them aesthetically a lot more pleasing.
Yeah, better than the Borg did. Yes.
Yeah, certainly. But culturally, we don't have to, be walking around speaking monotone and.
Well, I like the way you define that. And what's interesting to me about this is that question actually came from a poll that was over on Gizmodo, and they took the whole when do we stop being human from a somewhat different tack. They had a picture of RoboCop, and it said, "How much of your body would you have to replace with machines before you could no longer be considered human? Let's break it down into percentages." And then the choice was 10% or less, up through 90%, versus the last choice, you can take away nearly everything, but if our brains are replaced by machines, we cease being human. Or finally, there was, as long as some shred of original tissue survives, we're still human. Now, I think what you would argue, if I can paraphrase what you just said, you would add a third choice that says, as long as the original as long as the heritage survives, as long as the original drive survives, it doesn't matter if the whole entity, if the whole being gets moved over to a new substrate, that's still a human being.
That's right. And it's still a person, which might be a more important question legally at some point. When do we consider people that have been augmented, are they still considered people? Are AIs that are, began their life as an AI but evolve into something, more significant, can they ever be a person? I think these are real questions that at some point we're probably going to have to solve as a culture.
Yeah, and I would just add that going back to our my greater humanity versus kind of a purer definition of humanity, seeing as we were talking about going from sub to post-human state, yeah, the post-humans are part of greater humanity, but when do they stop being what we are currently? I think there is a leap when you encounter a being who is simply beyond not only your capability, but the capability of anyone who has ever existed before. Right?
Yeah.
When you meet that person, that's a post-human, right? That being is no longer human in that stricter, narrower sense, but definitely still human in the greater humanity sense. Because come to think of it, what about a machine intelligence? What about one that is programmed to evolve up from the insect level that makes its way all the way up from that level to human level intelligence, befriends us, looks at us, and says, "Yes, I'm part of this."
Yeah.
Does that intelligence get adopted into humanity? Is that part of humanity?
Well, this movie had a lot of flaws to it, but Bicentennial Man was basically that story. And one of the biggest flaws to it was, death is what makes us human. Well, no, I don't think so. death is not what makes us human. Doing everything we can to avoid death, it seems to me to be a more human thing that we do.
Dying is a thing humans do. It's
what we do not by design.
By default, not
by default.
Choice.
When all else fails, we fail. You know, I mean, that's what it comes down to with death. But the movie did have a lot to say about that, and right there on his deathbed. Andrew was adopted into the human family by the Supreme Court of the world, I guess is what that was. And I guess the idea at that point, it took him 200 years to be accepted that way. Apparently he was the only one in this world, which strikes me as a little strange. But he was accepted finally. The history of civil rights is one of more and more inclusiveness as we move through history. Just thinking back on how this country was founded, they had high ideals in the writing of the Constitution about the freedom and how all men are created equal. But their idea of what amounted to a person, or at least in the sense of who could be free and who is equal, it really came down at that moment to white men of a certain age and
who owned land.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you really had to be a landed gentry almost.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, that definition has broadened over time to include women, people of all races, and certainly owning property is not has nothing to do with anything anymore. So that's sexual orientation and all this, we're still working through those issues as well. But as these other questions come up, if history is any guide, there'll probably be some resistance followed by acceptance. And
I think actually that the American experience is one particular very good example of what has really been the overall human experience, that humanity throughout history has been increasingly broadening its definition of humanity. Certainly, there have been huge steps taken back by certain groups over the years, but when you think about the fact that at one time we lived in very small, very fearful tribes,
right.
who regarded basically the people over the next hill as existential threats, and they often were.
Right. And you did what you could amongst your own people to dehumanize your enemy so that you wouldn't feel bad about killing them. It was important not to feel bad about killing them, because if you didn't kill them, they were going to kill you. And,
exactly.
As we've, hopefully moved to into a society, into a culture where we can expand the idea of our tribe and take in larger and larger groups of the human race, to the point that we every human on Earth, we can think of them as part of our tribe.
Yeah, the greater tribe. That's the thing. It's the human tribe. We grew from tribes to nations, and suddenly there was a much bigger group that was human. Although people of other nations, the Greeks referred to the outsiders as the Hexano, which from where we get our xenophobe. They were just the other, right? The
outsiders.
The people you don't want to have anything to do with. But you get to Rome, and a couple centuries in, they make kind of a leap, and they say, you know what? Actually, you can be from any of these other nations, and you can become a citizen of Rome. That was not perfectly implemented, and they still had loads of problems. But that was a huge step in the right direction. Suddenly, when humanity started being recognized in people who traditionally had not been recognized as human, and per your point, it has continued along this way. Now, DC is asking, why is it so important to be considered human anyway? Maybe there's something better, but not human, which we can become in the future, which will be more to our liking at that time. Well, I think that's kind of where we're going with the whole post-human, sexy, immortal billionaires with superpowers. But you kind of need the word human now, because we need a baseline for beings that we inherently accept the value of. That's what we're talking about. Beings who are regarded as being of like value to oneself, right? That's kind of the definition of personhood or humanity, or I don't know. You're the lawyer, Stephen. You tell me.
Well, I think the more important term is going to eventually be person.
Yeah.
Because at some point, for the word human to retain any meaning, it's going to probably revert to just what is biologically Homo sapiens. Okay. And for people who are not human, they'll still be considered people and have all the rights and duties that other people have. So
the interesting parallel for personhood is the corporation. The corporation is currently the only other entity other than a biologically human being that has personhood under the law in our system. Is that true?
That's
there's
correct.
Nothing else that's a person. A chimp isn't, and my laptop isn't, but the company I work for legally is a person.
Yeah, it can be sued. It can. It has duties. It has certain rights. It has to pay taxes.
Yeah, but it's not a citizen. It can't vote.
Right.
Although not my company, but companies can, unduly influence Congress, and they can lobby, and they can do a lot of other things that, that human beings can do. But they can't vote. They can't run for office. So I mean, they're persons, but they're not citizens. So there may yet be some interesting distinctions that will still have to be tangled through, especially because what if you have a corporation that is itself a sentient entity?
Yeah.
I don't know. What happens when an AI will, or how about this speculative question? Will AIs have to incorporate in order to gain rights as persons under the law?
I hope not. I hope it's. I really hope it'll be more simple than that. But that's interesting.
Yeah, well, they should have a more straightforward route, but I guess if all else fails, they could always incorporate and get some recognition under the law. All right, well, I think now it's time to turn our attention to the questions that DC provided, because I think those are, in fact, a restatement of our third question. Our third question was, what will be the relationship between humanity and post-human artificial intelligence? And DC kind of took that and ran with it. He responded, is there anything that current-day humans have to offer the future? In other words, is there any kind of value in the apparent inefficiency of our brains or our irrational emotional states or something that humans have which superintelligences aren't likely to replicate, perhaps because they simply won't want to replicate that attribute? And he goes on, he says, we still have an obvious footing on pattern recognition talents, but we know AI will match and pass that eventually. I would suggest that AI will match and pass that before they even become sentient.
Oh, yeah, and I think that they'll match and pass it within the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Another way of asking the question is, if we don't merge with machines and AI advances separately from us, will there be anything special about us which an advanced AI will view as a basis for our continued relationship with human beings? Personally, I can't think of anything we have to offer a superintelligence, but maybe we do have something unique, and it's so obvious that we take it for granted and have difficulty naming it. Okay, so Stephen, let's break this down. Let's take it to, first off, is there anything that current day humans have to offer the future?
Well, that's a big one, isn't it? I think as we go forward, what we're hoping for is a future in which none of us get left behind. You know, we don't want a situation where, the world explodes in intelligence and it's just, this utopia, but we can't even appreciate, where intelligence is moving and the state of the art, because we've just been completely left behind. We're the poor stepbrother or something that's been left behind. The inheritance is passed on to another being. That'd be a pretty sad and state of affairs, to be quite honest. So obviously what we are hoping for is a future where we can change along with the AIs. We can become co-equals with them and offer something. But of course that means changing to the point that past what you're talking about, DC. So I guess the simple answer to your question is no.
Okay.
Think about the analogy that comes to my mind is we still have horses in this world.
Okay.
We have horses. But very, very few people ride them to work.
Right, right.
We get in our cars and ride to work. Why? Because our cars can go a lot longer. They don't have to be refueled every 5 miles with hay. They're just much easier to maintain. They're trustworthy. They're not going to run off and do their own thing. They don't have minds of their own. We just have found that cars are a great thing to have, but we still have horses. And why is that, do you think, Phil? Why does anyone ever care to ride a horse? For any reason whatsoever.
Well, we like horses. We've bonded with horses. We have a long standing, second only to dogs, is the relationship, I think, between humanity and horses. Unless you want to count cats in there someplace, but just counting the important animals. Just kidding, cat lovers. Just kidding. Horses are our friends. We like horses, so we keep horses around. And in fact, most of the people who—it's interesting you mentioned people who ride horses to work. Most of the people whose jobs involve horses, in the U.S. anyway, in this day and age, the majority are in entertainment or they're athletes. There are probably more people who ride horses for that reason than the few, I guess, professional cowhands who are left who do ride horses as part of their employment, or the occasional horse mounted cop in a big city or something like that. There's a few odd things like that, but by and large, we keep them around because we think horse riding is interesting and fun. It reminds us of a different time. It is romantic to us. It is it's something we value as part of our heritage, and we value the animals themselves. I would say that's why they're still horses.
I think that there may be a parallel between mostly original substrate humans in the future and the place that horses have in our society today. And that sounds pretty heartless to compare humans with animals, but I'm not meaning to say that to make the comparison as if people would somehow be animals are kept in cages or something in the future. I'm saying that there's some parallel between that. Horses do not have the same contribution to society that they used to. We don't depend on horses the same way that we used to. We don't hook them up to our wagons and go into town anymore. That's not what we do with horses anymore. But they are kept around, but it's almost a novelty.
Right.
For
sentimental reasons, because we appreciate them and like them. So by analogy, the post-human, superhuman intelligence of the future might keep mosh humans around or, not interfere with their staying around.
If that's what they choose to be, if somebody wants to remain a mostly original substrate human, a mosh is what they're called, I guess, in the terms. But if you want to stay that way, then stay that way. But you'll be almost almost a novelty in some ways, you know.
Yeah, you're there as a novelty. You're there as a pet, in a sense. Although, in fact, if you recall, when John Smart was on a couple months back, he pointed out that the pet analogy is actually unfair in the other direction. That's actually giving us too much credit relative to the post-human intelligences, and that, in fact, to them we'll be more like beloved plants.
I guess how far post-singularity are you looking, I guess, is what that,
yeah,
is what that comes down to.
As long as we're beloved plants, you know, that's the key.
I hope to make the jump, actually, Phil. I would like to.
I would rather be one of the intelligences with a odd, quirky fondness for mosh humans. I think that's, in fact, where that fondness will come from. It will come from the human presence, the human continuity that carries on into post-humanity. Well, I'm going to take the question from a slightly different angle. And let's go back to the first question. Is there anything that current-day humans have to offer the future? And I want to break that down into two ways of reading that question, okay?
Okay.
Is there anything that current-day humans have to offer the future right now versus is there anything that current-day humans have to offer the future in the future? And the answer to the second question is no.
Yeah, that's what I meant when I said no.
Yeah. You know,
okay.
Once the post-humans have taken over, there's just not an awful lot that they can do. But is there anything that current-day humans have to offer the future right now? Yes. In fact, we have everything to offer. We have the future itself to offer. And, in fact, those post-human intelligences, even if they're not sentimental, I think will recognize that they owe their existence to us. I hope they recognize that. In fact, it is the progress that we have made and the choices that we have made that have allowed them to exist. So I think there is a lot that current-day humans have to offer the future. In fact, the future is in the hands of current-day humans. Whatever is going to happen is up to a bunch of moshes.
That's right.
It's up to a bunch of moshes who've started to get these ideas about nanotechnology and artificial intelligence and the singularity and the world being transformed. And it's what those shaved, you know, apes decide to do with those possibilities that will determine whether, whether we have the Terminator hard takeoff, whether we have these vast super intelligences that are able to have all these incredible experiences that they will value. And so I think that in that sense, we become maybe even more important than the horse, okay?
Yeah.
Because you know what? We could have gotten here without the horse. It might have taken longer, but we could have gotten here without the horse. We couldn't have gotten here without the us, right? And I think there will be that level of backward identification to moshes. Even moshes who look at the post-humans and say, we want no part of you, we don't want to be you. The post-humans, I hope, will look back at them and say, okay, well, that's sweet. You're a petulant child, but we love you anyway.
Yeah.
And, that the relationship, at worst, would work that way, that they're simply indulgent of us because they recognize that they have this really tremendous debt to us for the fact that they even exist.
Right.
Now,
well, we hope it goes down that way.
Yeah, well, that's the future we want to. And you know what? If I'm one of the post-human intelligences, barring any big change of heart here over the next couple thousand years, that is, I promise to look at it that way. Okay.
So. Okay. So if I decide to stay a mosh, you'll still like me, I guess.
I will. I will indulge you as I do now, Stephen. Okay. Actually, things will change very little between us, to tell you the truth.
That's great. That's great.
I think I owed you that for a comment earlier this evening.
yes, you did.
Now, so if we
shaved apes plus Aubrey Gray, will have a lot to say in how the future is created. That's what I'm getting from that. So
absolutely, and when you turn the question around, I think you get the same answer, because
yeah.
Where DC says if we don't merge with the machines, and AI advances separately from us, will there be anything special about us which an advanced AI will view as a basis for a continued relationship? Well, again, I think it's the same question and it's the same answer.
Yeah,
it's the continuity. It's the fact that yes, we've broken off, but you know, if not for our ascension from Lucy to Ben Goetzel, right? The AIs would not be there, right?
Yeah, so. Exactly. Well, you know, think about it this way: what we wouldn't give to find a tribe of Lucys, and you know, in some hidden corner of the Congo, you know, what would scientists and what would they give for that opportunity to get to meet, you know, people like that?
Absolutely.
You know, and maybe to some extent it'll be something like that. It'll be, you know, of great interest to future people that are not necessarily human, that there be humans around to see. You know, I don't know if it would go beyond that.
I think that's true. Even today, this is hardly an analogy, but even today, people like to go visit Amish towns, right, and look at the quaint, interesting pre-technological way that people used to live, right?
Yeah.
That you know, even for people who aren't scientists, just as you know, gawking tourists, we say, ah, that's very interesting. I want to go see what that's all about. Even more so if you have an opportunity to interact with people who are truly primitive, you know, that wouldn't appeal to me, actually. I don't know that I'd want to go live with hunter-gatherers, but there are people who definitely would, and I think that's probably where the more serious scientific interest in the subject would kick in. Anytime an isolated group of humans is found, there's immediate scientific interest in that because it is so valuable in providing insights as to how we got to where we are. You can connect the dots between what those folks are experiencing and the world that we live in now in a way that you can only speculate about if you don't have them to look at. So yeah, I think that just from a standpoint of, in addition to novelty and gratitude and sentimentality, there's a certain scientific value to keeping moshes around.
Right. I just wonder, you know, obviously what you would hope for is a situation where if a particular mosh decides I don't want to be a mosh anymore, I want to advance.
For anyone who's just joined, mosh is plain old human, mostly
yeah,
original just, substrate human.
Yes,
a plain
old human looks out at the world and says, "Boy, this looks like an exciting thing to be involved in. I want to be involved," and so they decide to join up. And to advance, that there wouldn't be anything holding them back. To me, it would be cruel to be left in a situation where you couldn't, or where you're stuck. Sorry, no, this is what you are, and you get to stay here. So
yeah, one of the things I imagine is that the door would always be open.
Yep.
Now, the thing is, a given mostly original substrate human, a given regular human, would have an awful lot of catching up to do. And might not ever catch up with those who have gone on before and have experienced millions of years every year in the time since the singularity. But I think that way forward would always exist.
Yeah.
So let's check in on the chat room. And DC, I'm going to put the question to you. Have we adequately answered your question? Give him a moment to respond here. There's been some interesting discussion in the chat room tonight where our missing our chat host this evening. Sally is inexplicably not with us. We hope all is well with her and look forward to having her back on the program.
DC is suggesting a book called The Genius of the Beast. I guess I'll have to look into it.
Genius of the Beast. I've not heard of that. We'll have to check that out. Add that to the reading material. Well, DC, we're going to take it as a given then that we did adequately address all your concerns. I think that if you're listening, you had your chance. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit. I want to clarify one thing. Yes, think so. Can't find much to disagree with, except possibly. Oh, then he gives us the old ellipsis.
Okay.
Nice.
He's probably going to come up with like 10 paragraphs now. He's going to write.
He's messing with us. Okay. While DC is messing with us, let me just say once again, apologize for any confusion I caused last week in jumping the gun on announcing the show moving to Sunday evenings. We will be on Sunday evenings beginning this coming Sunday, and we will do 2 weeks on Sundays, and then I think we'll be back to Tuesday, but that's awfully far in the future. Hard to predict for sure, but we will be on this coming Sunday and a week from Sunday as well.
Excellent.
With that, Stephen, let's see, DC did provide a little more. The assumption that we are necessary to the future, it will evolve without us. We address them. Okay, good. All right. Well, that's what we're here for, is to satisfy our listeners, and if we can do it one at a time, all the better. So, Stephen, what's on tap for the music this evening?
The song tonight is Steal This Song by Dreaming in Stereo. Now, I mean, here's an artist that's actually encouraging the public to steal his music, or at least this song. So this is an example of the free economy in action here. The lyrics actually say he's not interested in money. He just wants to kiss our ear, basically. He wants us to hear his music and to be entertained by it. So we'll take him at his word, and that's exactly what we did.
All right, so Steal This Song. He's providing free content in a free content world. Well, that's exciting, and that will be our topic 3 weeks from tonight, assuming we're back on Tuesday, but 3 shows from now is the more precise way of putting that. We'll be working our way through nanotechnology in the same way that we've worked through artificial intelligence over the next few weeks, the last couple of weeks, I should say. So look forward to that discussion. Stephen, thanks for getting that song online and for your participation this evening. DC, thanks again for your brilliant questions. For everyone listening live, participating in the chat room and otherwise, and for everyone listening to us via MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to talking with you again in the very near future. Until then, live to see it.
Labels are off soon.